karaoke, hey baby, karaoke. I'm Danny Checker, your news dissector.
That's me, that's me, that's what I think. That's me, that's what I think.
Demands for justice, losing their hope. Working class solidarity, co-opted battle that hasn't stopped. Issues, 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 issues. CNN, ABC News, WBCN, Boston.
That's me, that's me, that's what I think. That's me, that's what I think.
And this is really me. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, here with Polarity One, Polar Levine, here on the Progressive Radio Network every week at this time. And we're going to be joined from a taxi cab by none other than Harvey Wasserman, who's in New York trying to get the United Nations, listen to this, to get involved in the whole Fukushima crisis before it spirals out of control and threatens the survival of the world. Are you there, Harvey Wasserman?
Yes, Danny, I am. We are in a cab on Madison Avenue, passing 51st Street on our way to 59th Street, on the circle, to unfurl our banner at CNN because of the ridiculous, obnoxious, totally paid-for pro-nuclear disinfomercial they're planning to run tonight on nuclear power.
Not CNN. CNN is objective.
Yeah. CNN, Canadian Nuclear Network. I need a better word for the C there, but it's a crapola might work in this case. They are running a documentary, a purported documentary tonight called Pandora's Promise. It's totally pro-nuclear, really obnoxious. I'm actually in it, along with Helen Caldicott, Ralph Nader, Amory Lovins, Bobby Kennedy, and the purpose of our presence in the movie is to make us look as bad as possible. It's a really obnoxious piece of work, and CNN has been promoting it and nuclear power all day long. It's amazing how pro-nuclear CNN is, and so I actually put up a little image, a Photoshopped image showing the CNN logo over a banner that says Fukushima, the whole world is watching. We're gonna go over there now and have a little gathering and film.
Okay, well, listen, stay with us as we go there. Take us with you into CNN if you get there, given traffic in New York. You may not before the next half hour is up. But stay with us.
That's right.
And we're going to be back in a minute with Harvey Wasserman, the man I first knew as by the name of Sluggo, who's actually a host on Progressive Radio Network. Sartopia is his banner. He's an anti-nuclear activist. We worked together on the No Nukes concert back in the day when there was a World Trade Center, which we'll hear about more later as well. So stay with us here on PRN-FM, the News Dissector Radio Hour.
A blue sky is dripping red. A sea of oil anoints the dead. Tell me again, what's that you said? Was that your paying? I hear somebody praying. The innocent will foot the bill. The guilty aren't speaking. The god of greed is the son of a man. Yeah, this was not some cosmic plan. Lay on 70 virgins in the sky. 70 virgins in the sky. 70 virgins in the sky. Yeah, tank full of gas and a plane to fly.
Yeah, that's the incomparable Polarity One, 70 virgins.
And we're playing it in part because we're going to be talking about 9/11 later on in this program with a television producer, investigative journalist, who's been really trying to challenge some of our beliefs about this, at least the beliefs that have been foisted on us, and we can hear about his work to try to get to the bottom of unanswered questions about 9/11. The reason we have Harvey Wasserman with us, he's in New York. Tomorrow, apparently, at the United Nations, there's going to be a big rally to try to get the UN to take a stand on this situation in Fukushima. Apparently, you know,
well, Danny, actually, we delivered petitions today.
Okay, forgive me. Thanks for jumping in. Okay.
We delivered 150,000 signatures demanding that the nations of the world step in at Fukushima. Clearly, the Tokyo Electric Power Company and the Japanese government are incapable of coping with the incredible catastrophe that's at Fukushima now. We have today, the Tokyo Electric Power Company began bringing down fuel rods from the crippled Unit 4. We have a situation where there were four explosions at the Fukushima reactor, three meltdowns, three radioactive cores in the ground somewhere. They don't know where. 11,000 fuel rods scattered around the Fukushima site. 1,500 rods that have to be brought down at Fukushima Unit 4. Hundreds of tons of water every day pouring radioactive through the Fukushima site into the Pacific Ocean. It is an apocalyptic event. And in the midst of all this, CNN and the other American media, the corporate media, are just talking about more nuclear power plants. It's absolutely insane, and of course, not covering what's really happening.
Why do you think that is? How can they downplay a crisis like this, this Fukushima crisis?
Because it's the end of nuclear power, and the end of nuclear power means the end of the utility industry, because once you undercut the central control of the nuclear power stations that are in the hands of the big corporations, then the renewables, solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels, that stuff will come in, and the utility industry will be done. So this is a major linchpin of centralization of control of power, nuclear power, and they're terrified of renewables. But the fact is that what's happened in Fukushima far exceeds the worst case scenarios in many people's books. We now have had radiation detected off the coast of Alaska. This is a very serious contamination. It's obviously going to carry on down the west coast of the United States. The entire Pacific Ocean is being compromised, and the worst of it is that there's no end in sight. There's really no indication that they will be able to stop the flow, the huge flow of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean at Fukushima. And, you know, it's really a doomsday scenario, Danny. I don't know.
What you're saying is this is a global problem, though. It's not just a Japanese problem. And yet, in our media, that's how it seems to be treated, as if it, you know, if we just think of it in terms of Japan, we're not involved.
Well, I've been posting articles every day at www.nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org. And I tell you, it's gotten more and more depressing. There are very serious indications of major impact already on the Pacific Ocean, reports of large dead zones, disappearance of fish. And the point is, okay, the Pacific Ocean is very big, but the amount, the radioactivity, the isotopes that are coming in from Fukushima are very lethal, and doesn't take much of the cesium, strontium, iodine, tritium, all that stuff dispersed around the ocean to do serious damage, and of course, it tends to concentrate in the fish and in the other bioorganisms in the ocean. I mean, this is really, Danny, an apocalyptic event, and the media, the major media, the corporate media, is doing their very best. They're doing a great job of ignoring it and running, you know, so-called controversy about more nuclear plants. It's absolutely insane, grotesquely irresponsible. So you'll be glad to know we're on Central Park South now, headed over to a couple blocks from Columbus Circle.
The Time Warner Center.
We will unfurl our banner that says Fukushima. The whole world is watching, and we'll make a YouTube and call it a day. But it's great to talk to you about this. People want to find out more.
Hold on, Harvey. We have an actual question.
Is the Fukushima plant still online, or are these problems just the runoff from the initial earthquake?
Okay, so here's the deal. There were 54 reactors operating in Japan when the tsunami earthquake hit on March 11th, 2011, and basically blew up Fukushima. And so all 54 reactors are shut, thankfully. The units 1, 2, 3, and 4 at Fukushima Daiichi, those are toast, and they'll never operate again. 5 and 6 could conceivably be operated, but that's not going to happen. And so the only good thing that came out of this is that we those reactors are shut. And the people that are wanting to keep them shut, the people in Japan, I think, will be successful, even though the current prime minister of Japan is very pro-nuclear. But the reality is that the Fukushima site, Daiichi site, is destroyed, essentially. It's catastrophically impacted. We had four explosions there, which appear to be hydrogen, although one of them may actually have been a nuclear explosion.
And this is all just a consequence of that same earthquake. The site's been shut down, but this is still the mess that's popping and spilling.
What kind of response are you getting from the United Nations or people over there when you've tried to internationalize this issue and call for responsibility by the global community?
Nobody's saying anything. All these big corporations, these countries are don't want to mess with the Japanese. And by the way, Danny, the Japanese government is about to pass a state secrets act, which will make it much more difficult for people inside in Japan to put out information. And we're actually getting less information from the Japanese than we got from the Soviets during Chernobyl. And, so when you're winding up with in Japan as a Soviet Union without the social programs, Gorbachev was much more forthcoming than the Abe administration has been about this whole situation.
Hasn't there been a major leader in Japan who has spoken out against nuclear power? Aren't there many people that are concerned?
Actually, we had five former prime ministers of Japan now come forward and say that they're now against nuclear power, even though they were for it when they were prime minister. So there has been a major shift. The last prime minister, Naro Kan, who was in charge when Fukushima happened, has now become very outspoken in his opposition to nuclear power. So, the reaction by the government now has been to shut down the ability to speak out. Japan is really on the brink now of becoming an atomic dictatorship, and it's a very serious situation. So we're
now TEPCO, the company responsible for this, the Tokyo Electric, weren't they also kind of pitching nuclear power plants in the United States based on their track record?
Well, they actually the Prime Minister of Japan has just, in the midst of all this, has just gone to Turkey to sell nuclear plants in Turkey. I mean, these guys are crazy and completely irresponsible. Because I'll tell you, the more just reading the stuff every day about the consequences of this accident are terrifying. We've already had a serious indication of thyroid damage to children near Fukushima in Japan. As high as 40%, which is what you would expect, because iodine that comes out of this plant goes straight to the thyroid, and children have small thyroids, and the impacts can be very rapidly.
Well, is the World Health Organization involved? Is there any international agencies that are monitoring all of this, the international nuclear agencies?
The International Atomic Energy Agency of the United Nations is very pro-nuclear, very much a creature of the nuclear industry. And so we don't get anything from them. The World Health Organization essentially toes the line when it comes to talking about nuclear power and hiding the health effects. So we have really no strong, reliable global organization to deal with Fukushima outside of the environmental NGOs. And, you know, you simultaneously have this huge propaganda push, very Soviet in its nature, to tell us how nuclear power is needed to fight global warming.
I would assume just the information about what's going on currently over there would be enough to counteract the propaganda, wouldn't it?
Well, that's why you're not hearing it. This is really the worst thing that has ever happened in this world. I mean, I say that
Whoa,
without...
That's a big claim.
It can't be as bad as Obamacare, really.
Yeah. Well, before Chernobyl, you know, I guess you would have said the Holocaust in Germany, but this is different, and we had nuclear testing and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the fact is that in the long term, probably more people will die from Fukushima. The amounts of radiation that are coming out are just, you can only say apocalyptic.
Is it that they feel that if we don't know about it, we won't be upset about it, and somehow they can continue doing what they're doing by just sort of isolating this as an issue and pushing it off to the side?
Yes, but, you know, I think it's very hard to get your head around this stuff and to understand and to face up to how bad it is. We have 400 tons, this is not gallons, 400 tons of radioactive water pouring into the Pacific Ocean every day. This has been 2.5 years. There is absolutely no indication, no reason for it to stop. You have 3 radioactive cores that melted into the ground. We don't know where they are. They're lost, you know? And then there you have Unit 4, which blew up, which has spent fuel rods flying 100 feet in the air. You have 11,000 fuel rods scattered around the site. You know, this is a gaping hole in the entire ecology of the Earth with massive untold quantities of radiation.
Is there a fishing industry that's making noise?
Yeah, the fishermen off the coast of Japan now are making their living catching fish. They are measured for radiation. The fishing industry off of Japan is dead. The Koreans and Chinese are not buying Japanese fish anymore. And the produce, the food, is contaminated. It's beyond tragic.
Is the industry making... Are those fishermen and whatever industry is tied to it making noise about it?
Yes, but they can't do anything. They're powerless there. Nobody can do anything because you have a private utility company that's absolutely incompetent, that was stupid enough to build these reactors in an earthquake tsunami zone in the first place. They don't have the resources to cope with the situation at Fukushima. It's incredibly expensive. They actually cut wages at Fukushima by 20% after the accident. And Reuters, which has been doing some coverage there, had a very big story about the labor situation at Fukushima, which is horrendous. And
excuse me, Harvey Wasserman, can you give us an update on your sojourn to CNN?
Yeah, you're hearing the fountains at Columbus Circle. I'm now at Columbus Circle.
So CNN is in view. Time Warner building is right in front of you.
Yes, Time Warner, and then there's a big CNN sign on the building above. And if you're interested, we put up a really cool sign. Our banner says Fukushima, the whole world is watching. And my daughter photoshopped it so that the CNN is right above that banner, and you can see it on Facebook and at newsfree.org.
Now, did you call to protest the way CNN used you in this film? What was the reaction?
They refused to interview. There are no interviews with any anti-nuclear activists in Pandora's Promise. This is a 90-minute film allegedly about nuclear power, and it shows where, you know, Ralph Nader and Amy Lovins and Helen Caldicott and me and Bobby Kennedy, but we're never interviewed. It just has clips of us, and they're designed to make us look as bad as we possibly can.
Did you protest this to CNN? Did you speak to anyone?
Well, that's what we're doing right now. We're not going to go into CNN. We're not going to bother with CNN. We're just going to make a YouTube and use out there.
Anderson, are you listening? Anderson Cooper, are you listening to this? Will you have this man on tonight? Let's go, guys. CNN, a little fairness there. Go ahead. What were you saying?
Anderson Cooper, his coverage, his initial coverage of Fukushima was actually very good, and it was interesting. A little ways, about a week into the accident, he was reporting from Fukushima, and he and Sanjay Gupta started to discuss the health impacts, and you could see Anderson Cooper kind of freaking out, and his next report was from Tokyo. He got the hell out of there, and I will never return to Japan. I think it's way too radioactive. There are hot spots all over the place, and if things get any worse at Fukushima, you know, it's a possibility of very, very big dead zones throughout the country. Tokyo is only, it's less than 200 miles away. I'm sure, I guarantee you, very large quantities of radiation went into Tokyo. But the, you know, this administration, the Abe government is very keen on making sure the public is not informed. But the discovery of Danny of radioactivity in the water off of Alaska in significant quantities, this is really a turning point. It's very, very serious.
Is it reaching China? Is China receiving any of these gifts from Japan?
China's on the other side. China's on the other side, but they have reacted. Of course, this is Fukushima is a major reason that Germany decided to move to shut their reactors and to switch to renewable energy.
You know, Harvey, I would just caution you, because I've tried to shoot outside the Time Warner building, and they have a security zone around their building, which includes the sidewalk, and they don't want anybody shooting anything on that sidewalk. I saw them chasing a crew from Eyewitness News away from CNN. I guess there was some sort of, the story about how CNN's ratings have fallen to a new low. So I would just caution you to be concerned about this, because you may not even be able to have freedom of speech in America outside the CNN building.
Well, we're going to shoot from the Christopher Columbus statue here, and because the CNN logo is up in the air in the background, and we have the lovely sound of the fountains here in the distance. So that's what we're going to do. But CNN has been abominable about this. They've been very biased. All their little news segments have taken the side of the nuclear industry. Our interviews with the maker of the film have been very, very biased. It's ridiculous.
I hope John Stewart is listening, because I think he's been really hammering on CNN, and this gives him some reasons to hammer on them.
What? Yeah, I mean, Stewart would be a person.
And I have to give
contact.
You a disclosure here, Harvey. I was part of the original startup team at CNN in 1980, how low the mighty have fallen here, with Ted Turner abandoning it, the corporation seizing total control of it. And, the idea of a fair treatment of a subject like this seems to be something that's beyond them. I don't know why, but it seems to be.
Well, it's really, I've been watching them through the day. It's been quite infuriating. They set up the base, and they took very weak people. With some exception, they've got Kevin Camp. Michael Bruin was pretty good, but their advocates have been given the time by the moderators, and the moderators have been taking the side of the nuclear industry. I don't know what they think they're going to do. There's no market for new nuclear plants. Wall Street is very anti-nuclear, actually. Nobody on Wall Street wants to invest in new nuclear plants except Bill Gates, who has come forward, and he's investing in new reactors. And his buddy, Paul Allen, is the guy who funded this ridiculous documentary. So that's really what's going on there.
So the people who are supposedly progressives in the technology industry are actually anything but when it comes to challenging the profitability and the purposes of these corporations. CNN, maybe they want to turn the Time Warner building into a nuclear power plant, because they don't seem to be doing too well over there.
I'll tell you exactly what's going to happen with new nuclear technology, and you heard it here first. Bill Gates and a few other people, they'll put in a few hundred million dollars, which is pocket change to them, and then they'll write it off as a tax loss. They'll get a few billion dollars from the taxpayers. They'll pursue the technology. They'll make a big mess. The technology won't work. It'll be priced out. It's already priced out of the market by renewables. And then we'll have to clean up the whole mess with taxpayer money. Meanwhile, they'll have slowed down renewables so that the utility industry can make some more money. But the utility industry is obsolete now, and it too will pass. The world will be funded, will be powered by renewables. It's the only way we can survive on this planet. And if you go to nukefree.org and read what's going on with Fukushima, take some Prozac, get drunk, smoke some dope or whatever, because it is incredibly depressing. And,
okay,
Harvey
Wasserman, thank you so much for taking us on this trip with you over to CNN. You're down in the Columbus Circle right now protesting against the way CNN is covering this issue. And thank you for sharing all this with us. This is a problem, obviously, we're going to have to return to. It's extremely serious and extremely undercovered. Thank you, Harvey. Stay with us on News Dissector Radio on PRN-FM.
The Leuven brothers from the early 50s, a great country duo that sprouted the Everly Brothers later on, and singing about the great atomic power, which turned out to be very prescient. It turned out to be a very great power, didn't it?
It did indeed, and not always the kind of power that, you know, we should be worshiping at or worshiping anymore. You're listening to News Dissector Radio. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here with Polar Levine. And in this segment, we want to talk a little bit about a subject that I guess gets talked to about a lot here on PRN, and that is 9/11 and the issues of 9/11 that have not been covered very well and the difficulties of trying to cover them. And joining me in the studio is an old buddy of mine in from the state of Ted Cruz, the state of Texas, Roy Novoselsky. Did I do that right? Wrong? Close.
Novoselsky.
Novoselsky. There he is. Ray is a filmmaker. He's done the theatrical documentaries. He's been a director, writer, and producer. He did the film Press for Truth that you may remember. It was a powerful story of four New Jersey mothers who were widowed on September 11th, who found themselves forced into a battle with the Bush White House over the creation of the 9/11 Commission. It was shown in limited theatrical rollouts in 28 cities worldwide. It aired to an estimated 10 million viewers on foreign TV outlets, including Al Jazeera and Australia's History Channel, but not on any of the mainstream big-time channels here in the U.S. of A. And now Ray is continuing his investigation into aspects of all of this. We're talking about it now because just this past week, the engineers who have been challenging the 9/11 story, particularly what happened to Building 7, put up a big sign right across from the New York Times and held an event last weekend to challenge the New York Times. The particular story was not reported in the New York Times, to my knowledge, but they were out there trying to at least recognize that one reason this story has received the coverage it has is because of the media commitment to a certain narrative. the narrative that they reinforced over and over again without any critical perspective. So here you are, Ray, back in New York City, still talking 9/11. Why is that? What is it about this issue that holds your attention? I know you're not what they would call a conspiracy nut. You're a serious journalist and a serious producer. Tell us a little bit about your own trajectory, your own development on this issue, how you have come to understand it.
Well, Danny Schechter, the News Dissector, thank you for having me on. My old boss, when I worked with you in 09, I think you were the Hannibal Lecter of the financial sector. And I think the 9/11 issue was very similar to the financial crisis that developed in 08 that you covered so well in your book and in your documentaries, in that it kind of opened up this can of worms that was sort of inconvenient for a lot of the power structure, in that it exposed issues with not only criminality but also the fact that the lines sort of since 9/11, the lines have sort of continued to blur to the point where it's difficult to now see when certain actions within the U.S. government are criminal or not, whether it's malfeasance or misfeasance or whatnot. I think the wrong lessons got learned from 9/11, and that's why I continue to stick with that issue, because what got exposed was that there is an incredible level of incompetence and corruption within our government, and not always even at the top levels in the White House, the areas where the light shines the brightest, but sort of more troublesome is that it's in the mid-levels of the American bureaucracies, which stay in place decade after decade after decade, even as the top changes. And it's a very simple principle, but if, whatever system you're trying to run, if there's incompetence or there's people acting against the interests of the people in that system, then you need to clean house. You need to get rid of those people. And 9/11 presented us the opportunity to do that, and that was squandered. And unfortunately, the people that stayed in place there, you can see, have been involved with some of the issues that have come up over the last 10 years within our country.
Well, let's remind people about this 9/11 commission, which was the official investigation of 9/11 that confirmed the official story of 9/11. And other areas of inquiry were basically pushed to the side. But there were four women from New Jersey who lost their husbands, who began in their living rooms and in their basements, collecting documents and information in newspapers and magazines, and beginning to see inconsistencies, beginning to see that the story as presented had a lot of holes in it, so to speak. Tell us, how did you meet those women, and then what happened?
We reached out to them. They were nice enough to sit down with us. And once they'd interviewed, we really saw, originally we were going to do a documentary that was more about kind of where the media fell down in telling the story of 9/11, what they said and what they failed to say. But once we interviewed those women, we knew, okay, the movie needs to be about them and their journey, because these women were apolitical prior to 9/11. One was an independent, one was a Democrat, two had voted for President Bush. And they weren't really terribly active or concerned, and they lose their husbands in the Twin Towers, and they say, well, wait a minute. They start reading and researching a little bit. The internet's, become a possibility for the first time. You can kind of look into things a little deeper, and they start to see there are people throughout the U.S. government, FAA, NORAD, NSA, CIA, the whole alphabet soup, pretty much everywhere you looked, there were people who had made inexplicable decisions that had resulted in a failure to prevent 9/11. So they said, well, hey, common sense. Let's get a blue ribbon commission called, like happened after JFK, like happened after the shuttle disaster. And let's look into this. Let's find out who fell down, like who needs accountability, what holes need plugged up, what changes in the system, and let's get that fixed. And they were sort of, I guess, in their naivete, they were astounded to find when they got to Washington that no one had any interest whatsoever in seeing this commission called.
Except they had certain moral capital, because as right. victims, people who had lost their husband and 9/11 victims. So they had a certain standing to ask for questions. Okay.
Well, they quickly figured out how to play the news media, because, well, they two of them had voted for Bush, and they were surprised to find that the president and his administration were the most dead set against this investigation. So they decide, well, we've got to turn the tide of public opinion to force Congress to do the right thing, which appears to be what always has to happen. You get enough pressure in there, and finally people start voting the right way. And so they made a deal with each of these news organizations that interviewed them. They said, okay, you want to see our pain and our suffering, and you want to sell that to your viewers, right? So we'll give you that. But in exchange, you have to also cover these issues that we want to talk about. The failure here, the failure there. What are we going to do about that? We want an investigation. And in the end, they ended up getting the 9/11 Commission created. And
They were pretty smart about it, too. I mean, I spoke with a few of them. They were telling me how they would go down to get to Delaware and Maryland. And just before they went into Washington, they would dress up with pearls and high heels and look more presentable.
Right.
And would go to meet these congressmen who were very solicitous to these, quote, widows, welcoming them into their offices and, of course, quite willing to listen to them and agree with them and, you know, we feel your pain sort of thing. And,
sure.
And they played on that very successfully to get a sort of consensus going that we do need an investigation.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in the end, they were disappointed ultimately with the results. I think they were proud of the answers that they got within the commission's final report. But, you know, ultimately, I think the famous line from the commission was, everyone was at fault, so therefore no one was at fault. And they felt like, well, if everyone was at fault, then everyone was at fault. And let's start looking at who are we talking about specifically here, who needs to not be in their jobs anymore, and who maybe covered up their failures post 9/11 and lied to government bodies and investigations, and who needs to be therefore prosecuted.
And there was a person there who had been the national security advisor to several administrations, Richard Clark, who really attempted to be supportive, I think, to these women initially and to try to ask some of the questions they were posing. But himself, he got frustrated in the end, too, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, we met with Richard Clark in 2009, and in 2011, wow, 2 years ago now, we released a YouTube video of our interview with him, and he was telling us, you know, you brought up conspiracy theories, and you're right, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, we're talking about accountability, and yes, people failed in all the alphabet soup agencies, but in the CIA, there's one story that was sort of just inexplicable, just kind of beyond the realm of, it's the worst case scenario of all the 9/11 failures. And Richard Clark had written about it in his book, Your Government Failed You. And he says in the book, and I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, basically, I don't have much faith in the ability of the government to carry out any conspiracy. So I don't, you know, hold to conspiracy theory. But he says,
but
there is one that I just cannot seem to make sense of, that I can't make sense of any other way. And that was the story of what happened within the CIA's Bin Laden unit, and this, which was a small unit of 50 employees, basically in a basement down a hallway behind an unmarked door over in Langley, you know, being led by this guy, Rich Blee. And Michael Isikoff from Newsweek and Jane Mayer from The New Yorker, among other people, have called this pre-9/11 incident at the Bin Laden station one of, if not the worst intelligence failure in U.S. history. So we thought, well, okay, then if that was the worst intelligence failure and the Bin Laden unit was charged with, you know, everything al-Qaeda related, then it would seem like the guy, Rich Blee, who was in charge of all that, that's where accountability would start first and foremost. So what's the deal with this Rich Blee guy? And
you tried to speak to him?
We did. We actually went and knocked on his former residence. We had missed him by 2 months. We found his address just outside D.C. and knocked on the door. And there was a woman inside who was repainting the apartment who told us that she still had some of his mail, but that Rich hadn't been there for a couple months. But during that same trip, we talked with Richard Clark. And that's when Clark says to us, and it's the first time and still the only time he's ever talked about this, that, you know, he believes basically that the people in the Bin Laden station, Rich Blee and Alfreda Bukowski and Tom Wilshire and these various folks, they knew that two of the lead 9/11 hijackers had flown to the U.S. in 2000, but chose to hold on to that information for their own reasons and not tell the White House and not tell the FBI. And this was supported by a number of FBI agents that we also spoke with, including Pat DeMoro, who headed the FBI's 9/11 investigation after the attacks. They all felt that they could have stopped the attacks had the CIA's Bin Laden station simply provided them the information rather than try to keep it to themselves so that they could use it to pursue it, you know.
Did they ever pursue it?
We don't know exactly what they did. You know, a lot of people have given interviews now on this subject from the FBI, from the military, from the White House. CIA has never really given an interview. The only thing they ever did was when we released the Richard Clark interview, we gave George Tenet a heads up 1 month before we released it, and we sent it through his publisher to him. George Tenet, of course, the former CIA director at the time. And within 12 hours, George Tenet had reached out to Kofor Black, who was the former head of counterterror at CIA, and he reached out to Rich Blee, the head of Alex Station, the Bin Laden unit, and they issued us a joint statement, a one-page joint statement that kind of basically said, Richard Clark's crazy, he's never mentioned this before, why is he bringing it up now? But if you really look at the letter, which is online, and you can find it on our Facebook page at Secrecy Kills is the name of the page. The letter, it doesn't really deny that much. You know, it doesn't say, well, they were completely wrong. It denies in a really specific way, like top leadership didn't know about this in the 2000 time frame. You know, it's a lot of sort of legalistic playing with words, and it's not saying a whole lot at all. But that was the most we ever got out of the CIA.
So here you are, and in the course of your investigation, you noticed some footnotes, I believe. Mm. Footnotes to the 9/11 report that were kind of intriguing to you. Tell us about that.
Right. So footnote 44 to chapter 6.
Would everyone who's listening please open your 9/11 report? Okay, go ahead.
Well, and Danny, that's exactly what we had the head of the 9/11 Commission, Tom Kane, do way back in 2009. We managed, although our first movie was very critical of you know, his final report, we did manage to get in and talk with him, and we had him read that and explain what he thought it meant. And he, you know, he actually said, this is one of the most troubling aspects of our entire report, this particular thing. And I always wished we had asked, why did it only end up in a footnote then?
So what was the footnote?
So what the footnote said was...
Oh, can I ask you one thing?
Yes, yes, sir.
This is fascinating when you...
Yeah, really. So Kane wondered why. Was it somebody outside of Kane? And I forget who else worked with him.
Well, Zelikow was the executive director, and Hamilton.
So who was responsible for compiling the information, the final report?
I mean, if you read Philip Shennan's book called The Commission, you know, I think it's pretty clear that Zelikow... Philip Zelikow was mostly the gentleman responsible for...
And Zelikow was a Bush Republican, right? Or...
That was the thing, was that he was part of the transition team between Clinton and Bush, and he was a close friend of Condoleezza Rice, who was the National Security Advisor. And, of course, if you're doing a commission that's looking at the failures of 9/11,
right,
you're going to look probably pretty closely at the National Security Advisor.
So Kane didn't have input into the final.
I don't think he would say that. But my feeling is that the commissioners are largely figureheads who sign off on chapters, but that it's the executive director and the lawyers that actually do most of the investigating and decide what gets to the commissioners. Right.
Well, I would imagine he would say that if somebody said, well, why the hell is this
only in
the
footnotes? You're reading this, and you're reading the footnotes, which most people probably don't do.
Sure.
And you find this, what was it, footnote 44?
The first ones that found it were the Jersey Widows that we'd done our documentary press for Truth on.
And what did they say? Hey, look
at
this.
Well, there's this famous New York Times picture of them at the commission's final hearing where the books are being passed out, and you see Lori Van Auken with her mouth, you know, just wide open, and she's got the page turned open, and she's pointing to another Jersey widow, Mindy Kleinberg, and they've got this sort of WTF look on their face. And they were reading that footnote, and what it basically said was that after monitoring what we now know was the 9/11 planning meeting, which took place in Malaysia in January of 2000, so the CIA executed this wonderful operation where they, you know, they used 10 different CIA stations around the world, 7 different intelligence services to track various top al-Qaeda leaders to this summit in this condo. And after the summit's finishing up, come to find out, they look at one of the guy's visas and they realize he's got a U.S. visa. And they supposedly lose him and his partner. This is Khalid Almodar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. But they lose them for about a week. But then that following week, the two arrive in L.A. And they get a cable that comes in from one of their stations that says, hey, one of these guys flying to L.A. should probably look at that. And so the question was always, well, did they tell the FBI or didn't they tell the FBI? And they tried to muddy the waters by making it seem like they had. But what this footnote says is that not only did they not tell the FBI, but the same woman who ordered that the FBI not tell their superiors, because at the time, FBI people could be stationed inside of the Bin Laden unit at CIA. And so there were a couple stationed who tried to tell their boss in the FBI. And after telling him he couldn't, this same desk officer, who we now know is named Michael Ann, she sends an email throughout CIA saying that the information had been shared so that nobody else would attempt to share it. And so it was interesting because for the first time, you could see that this wasn't just a failure to share the information, but it was a very deliberate failure to share the information.
So you know, usually the real deal is in the details, right? In the small right. details that somehow escape notice. But you paid attention to it. You began looking into it. And where did that take you?
We got in a little hot water about 2 years ago with the CIA. And what happened was we were looking at this story, and we wanted to know who it was that ordered this desk officer, Michael Ann, to order the FBI not to tell this information to the larger FBI. And we started realizing there was this whole human being that if you look at the 9/11 Commission report and you look at the Justice Department report and so forth, you wouldn't even really know she exists. But we talked to a number of insiders and we started to figure out that there was this red-haired manager that was working under Rich Belie that was running that operation.
Should that be that woman, Rebecca, who's in the hacking scandal in London? Murdoch's editor?
It's got to be her.
It must be her. She has red hair? Enough said, okay?
It's this tough-as-nails woman with spiky red hair and bright red lipstick that we now know is named Alfreda Bukowski. And she currently heads the Global Jihad Unit. So essentially she runs intel for the war on terror for Obama now. She's moved up the chain since then. But at the time, she was this little manager within, you know, the Bin Laden station. And anyway, long story short, we were able to deduce her name through open source materials. She had been put into the covert status after 9/11 for no real reason, because she was not only a manager safely working in Langley, but she was on the analytical side. So she was never doing secret ops somewhere overseas. Her name was already out there. It didn't need to be protected. But they decided to go ahead and put it in there so she couldn't be, you know, called before Congress or testify in public. People couldn't report. Bottom line is, we figured out her name, and we sent an email to the CIA. And we said, we are about to release this article for Salon. We're about to release an investigative podcast called Who is Rich Belie? It's going to contain the name, and we would like to give her a chance to respond to these allegations. Because if we have this all wrong, we want to know.
And they must have loved receiving that.
Huh? I think they did. We got a call within an hour from this guy, Preston Golson, who's their media spokesman. And within short time, he threatened us with prosecution under the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, which we knew had never been applied to journalists in the past. But we also knew, you know, we went and talked with the ACLU's National Security Project Director, and he told us, well, look, it's pretty clear the government's looking for a test case in this area. And when they do it, it's not going to be a Lawrence Wright. You know, it's going to be somebody like you at the bottom, unheard of, you know. That's who they'll go after. So be careful, is basically what we got told. And, of course, now we've seen that they're essentially attempting to criminalize investigative journalism that applies to national security matters, in the case of the Fox News and AP and so on and so forth. They're starting to really make Glenn Greenwald's partner, who was
David Miranda.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And so, but at the time, this seemed like a kind of an outside the box thing. Like, wow, they can't do this. This has never been applied to
so
reporters.
So you actually were on to something, the full significance of which you still really don't fully know.
Right.
But you've been trying to ask questions about it, and you've been getting this incredible runaround, it seems like. Now, is anybody in the big time media you know, kind of jumped in here and say, hey, guys, we really want to do this story. We want to help you get this out. We want to raise these questions.
I never... The mainstream media, I'm constantly, I don't know why, I'm always surprised when they take so little interest in the things that that seem like it would be their job.
Are they aware of what you uncovered?
Well, one of our partners sent, I don't actually remember the name of the reporter, but someone at the New York Times received the overall story, and his response was very similar to the ones that we've gotten in the past when we found when we investigated things like this, which is that, well, this is already kind of out there. This story has been told. And it's like, well, okay, the fact that the CIA withheld information from the FBI has been told since about 2002 when Congress investigated. But the fact that it was purposeful, that we have the names, that reporters are being threatened, et cetera, that's kind of new. And it seems like news to us. And most people we've told seem, you know, interested. But the New York Times wasn't.
Right. You know, so it's sort of an insider game. Right. It's the people who specialize in this whole area who become the if you will, you know, the people who are the guardians of what should be discussed and shouldn't be discussed, what we supposedly already all know, which we usually don't all know.
I mean, the laziness, Danny, and I think you'll appreciate this story. Somebody from the Washington Post called us the day that the Daily Beast, we leaked the video of Richard Clark, the interview that we talked about a month ahead of our podcast release, and we gave it to Philip Shannon at the Daily Beast. And so that day we got a call from a gentleman from the Washington Post who said, hey, I read the Daily Beast article. I was wondering if I could get a transcript of the full interview with Clark. And I said, well, I'll do better. I'll send you the video as a link. And he's like, I don't know. That sounds like it's going to be a lot of work. Could you just...
It's going to be a lot of work.
Just to be able to watch that
video. To be able
video.
To watch it. And he was well, you know, we've got the original Daily Beast article. We'll just quote from that.
Well, Ray, thank you for sharing this with us. Really. It's an important story. It's still a story that hasn't been fully investigated or told. It's a story which, if anyone is listening, wants to help fund a documentary about it, please get in touch with us. Ray does excellent work. And, you know, this is a story, a passion of his for many years that has somehow eluded pickup, as we say, from other media outlets. So thank you for stopping by and sharing this with us. We appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Danny. Thanks, Paula.
Yeah, thank you, Ray.
I'm Danny Schechter here with the News Dissector Radio. The podcast of this show will be available tomorrow on my blog at newsdissector.net, I hope, and also in the archives at PRN-FM. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Please check out Media Channel and my blog at newsdissector.net. That's all I have to say. Thanks for listening.
And let's have Media Wars by the spectacular Polarity One.
Are we going to fix that technical problem?
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News. Breaking news.
Faking news. The media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN.
To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.